Good afternoon. This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and distinguished lecturer emeritus from York College, City University of New York, welcoming you to the September 5th Labor Day edition of Vantage Point here on 99.5 FM. That's WBAI on the Pacifica Network in collaboration with ycradio.org. That's right, my old college stomping ground. York College has an online radio station, and they plug in and tune in to Vantage Point every week. I'm delighted that they are doing so. It expands the audience for WBAI, and hopefully they get some useful information for students, faculty, and staff here on WBAI 99.5 FM. Today is Labor Day, and we have a Labor Day special, a Labor Day edition. We're going to be joined shortly by Bill Fletcher, and Bill Fletcher will be addressing the topic, the exploitation of black labor and extraction of black wealth, the case for reparations. We're going to continue to talk about reparations today, at the end of the show, we're going to open it up, because last week, there were those who wanted to specifically ask more questions about our fabulous show last week, which was on the state of the global reparations movement. What an incredible show that was. Positive feedback continues to come in. I want to thank those who matched my pledge of $100, though we did not meet our goal of getting 20. So we want to continue today to make that offer in order to support the station. Again, I offered and made a pledge of $100. I asked 20 people to join me in doing so that we'd raise $2,100. We fell short, but that's okay. We'll continue to push forward. Those who want to match that pledge, because the show was the premium, and you can go to the WBAI archives or on the IBW website, and you can hear that show again. It was incredible. You can call 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950 to say, I want to match the professor's pledge and do so in support of WBAI. Also, as I said before, I want to leave some space at the end of the show today after our interview. For those of you who wanted to call last week but did not because of you wanted to comment on reparations, so we'll be up on the soapbox again, opening the phones for people who want to call and discuss either the state of black labor, or we might talk about labor in general, but I'm really focusing today on black labor in particular, as well as to discuss the question of reparations in general based on our show last week. There'll be an opportunity to do that. Give you the number right now so you can file it. 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877 will be the number to call after our interview with Bill Fletcher, whom we're working to connect with as we speak. Again, this is Labor Day. And, you know, I think a lot of times people kind of forget what Labor Day is all about. A recent report poll shows, however, there is increasing interest and support for labor after really labor falling into into the low, I guess, in the 70s, down to an approval rating of like something like 38%. Terrible, actually. But now it's up to about 70%. Unfortunately, what we have is a scenario where we have, I think, 70% approval rate, but only 10% of labor participation, workforce participation. That is very, very low. I guess at one point it may have been as high as maybe 20%. I'm not quite sure. But in Western Europe, the degree of labor participation is much, much higher. It is not by accident that they, contrary to the MAGA madness and this whole notion of American exceptionalism, it is not by accident that most European nations have a much higher quality of living for working people than these United States of America. We've now been joined by Bill Fletcher, and Bill is one of our very special guests who comes on periodically, and I always like to talk to him about a range of issues, but also because I consider him one of our leading experts on labor in general, but also on the question of black labor. And so I asked him to come on today to address the topic of the exploitation of black labor, the extraction of black wealth, and the case for reparations. Bill Fletcher, welcome again to Vantage Point.
Oh, glad to be on, and happy Labor Day.
So, Bill, what I want to do is I want to really cover a range of topics in the next about 40 minutes or so, areas that that people may not necessarily associate with sort of the extraction of wealth. For example, the triangular trade and what that may have meant in terms of sort of building out the economy, not only of the South, but of the North. The post-emancipation, you know, after we were supposedly emancipated, there was all kind of peonage, sharecropping, tenant farming, but also the convict lease system. And then there's a way in which people may not be aware of or do not think of the extraction of wealth by way of exclusionary kinds of policies. For example, my father was a steel worker, and in Youngstown, Ohio, I mean, in the 50s, there were jobs that black people, black workers could not work in. I mean, you had sort of the labor gang, the sort of black jobs. And, you know, I remember people from the Hungarian Revolution coming in and they could get the top jobs, but there was a ceiling above which black workers could not go. So there's a range of things that I know you're very familiar with that I want to have you comment on. And so let's start, if you would, our discussion about the exploitation of black labor, extraction of black wealth, case for reparations, by talking a bit about the triangular trade. This is something that a lot of people are not aware of in terms of how the early wealth of this country was built.
So just as a quick point, thinking about something you just raised about the percentage of workers who are unionized, the high point, Ron, was actually 35%. 35% of the workforce was represented by unions. And as you said, it's now down to 10. So that gives the listener a real idea of what has happened. And then at some point we can talk about why. But let's go back to the triangular trade, as you were saying. To understand the significance of both the slave trade in Africans and the invasion of the Western Hemisphere, it's important to keep in mind that capitalism in Europe was developing mainly in city-states, like in Venice, mm-hmm. Genoa, and in what's now the Netherlands, and then it emerges in Britain, and sort of takes off from there. Now, in taking off, what's really important is that the introduction, the invasion of the Western Hemisphere by Europe provided Europe with the gold and silver that fueled the development of capitalism, the further development of capitalism. And there's very little debate about that. Some people try to do a little hemming and hawing, but there's very little debate. The gold and silver that the Portuguese and the Spanish grabbed using enslaved Native Americans, Indians, first, and then importing Africans, that gold and silver goes to Portugal and Spain, both of whom had not developed full-blown capitalism. They were still at, like, late stage of feudalism. So they enriched themselves, the ruling classes, they enriched themselves, but they shipped a lot of this gold and silver to the Netherlands, which was developing a banking system.
Mm.
And this gold and silver, this wealth that starts getting there into the Netherlands needs to be invested, because that's critical in capitalism. It's not just accumulating and holding on to the wealth personally. It has to be invested, and that invests in Britain, which helps to move British capitalism forward, which is then added to by the slave trade. Mm. So the slave trade, as Walter Rodney pointed out, as Eric Williams pointed out, was also essential in the development of capitalism and in the development of a whole set of industries, including the furthering of banking, shipbuilding, and other forms of trade. So you had the British and other Europeans basically going to Africa, fomenting conflicts among the different empires, tribal groups, etc.
Yes.
Grabbing prisoners, bringing them to the so-called New World, particularly in the beginning to the Caribbean and South America. And in the Caribbean, of course, what was critical there was the production of sugar.
Yep.
And what we saw happen in Haiti and what now is the Dominican Republic, etc. So all of this was central to the European capitalism taking off. In the absence of the invasion of the Western Hemisphere and in the absence of the slave trade, it's not at all clear what would have happened in terms of the development of capitalism. It's not clear what would have happened in those different cities or in Britain itself. That was the bottom line. We were the labor. We and the indigenous.
Right.
Now, the indigenous were being wiped out as a result of slavery, mass murder, wars that were being committed by the European invaders, and disease. And the disease was incredibly effective in wiping out populations. And so the Portuguese and the Spanish go and they bring over African labor, without whom it just the development would not have been able to take place.
Right. Yeah, Walter Rodney has the classic on that, as well as Sir Eric Williams has one, but Rodney's is much clearer. In this Western Hemisphere, you know, you talk about sugar production, but one of the byproducts of sugar production was molasses. And what would happen is, and this is one of the reasons why, we tend to think of slavery, enslavement only benefiting the southern states, but the extraction of wealth. First of all, this notion, it benefited these industries as they developed. Even if you were not involved in the slave trade directly, you benefited from it because you got jobs generated and textile industry, all these different timber, lumber industry, all these industries that are developing. But in the U.S., you know, you have rum then going up into New England, and into New England then the molasses then converted into rum and other forms of liquor, if you will, but mostly rum. But also that production ended up, you know, like exploding into the textile industry as this trade just exploded. And, you know, the manufacturing of sails, the ships and so forth. And again, this is an area that people don't look at a lot. And so if you were in New England, you may not have seen yourself as being directly involved in the slave trade, but certainly that wealth that was being generated benefited, not evenly, not equally, because that's the nature of capitalism, that it is uneven. So I just wanted to tease that out. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I just wanted to tease that out a little bit, because very often, you know, people just aren't aware of this triangular trade and even its impact, I would argue, on the American Revolution.
Well, no, absolutely. And there's so much that can be said about all of this. You're absolutely right that the development of industry in the northern part of the original United States is directly tied in with the slave trade and the production of goods of raw materials,
yes,
of molasses, etc., and all of that becomes critical. Now, it also is essential in understanding the roots of the Civil War.
Yes,
in that the Civil War was fought around two fundamental issues: slavery and free trade.
Yep.
And the developing industry in the northern part of the United States found itself in competition with British industry. And the British were able to produce cheaper goods of quality than northern U.S. industry could. And the southern slave states wanted to trade with Britain, and they didn't want obstacles to their trade with Britain and secondarily France. And so there were these battles in Congress that were battles over what many people, you may remember from high school and history, people talking about the protective tariff and all of this. And what this was the question of whether Northern industry would be allowed to develop, or would Northern industry be crushed by competition from Britain. And the lessons there are relevant to looking at the post-World War II and post-colonial situations on the planet, where the development of industry has often been thwarted by being forced to compete with more developed countries. So so the linkages that you're pointing out are really, really important for the listeners to get, that slavery was not an isolated thing. It was not something that was mainly about this or that white person having a few slaves to pick some cotton or pick vegetables or something. This was a fully developed industry, an all-round industry.
Right, absolutely. The other thing I wanted to just sort of leap forward, if you will, to have people understand is this whole question of, you know, the so-called emancipation that took place. Because, you know, one of the questions is, of course, there was no 40 acres and a mule, and we know all the details of why not and so forth and so on. But clearly there was a new forms of quasi-slavery that developed that also were extractive in terms of preventing black people from realizing their full potential, but sharing wealth in ways that benefited various whites in various ways. And among those, sharecropping, which we still hear about today, and tenant farming, but also the convict lease system. So I'm wondering, Bill, whether you would just talk about these sort of new forms of peonies that emerged right after emancipation and the Civil War.
So emancipation, first of all, critical for listeners to appreciate, would not have happened had it not been for us.
Right.
I don't mean that in the obvious sense. I mean it in the sense that, as W.B. Du Bois points out in the beginning of Black Reconstruction in America, there was what he called the Great General Strike, which was that once African slaves started hearing about the Civil War and, more importantly, hearing that Union troops were not returning the slaves to their former owners, people started to abandon the South, and they started marching north to the Union lines to join in the battle against slavery. In other words, it became a war of liberation. And it wasn't just about us. We were being saved by the white Northerners.
Right.
We were part of saving ourselves, emancipating ourselves. And that just can't be overstated because of this sort of paternalism that we've seen in U.S. history, including from white liberals, that leads you to believe that we were just sort of sitting on in the plantation, you know, eating watermelon and waiting to be liberated. No, people were involved in liberating themselves. Now, after the Civil War, there's supposed to be this period of Reconstruction, but the problem is, first, the assassination of Lincoln led to his vice president, Andrew Johnson, to become president. Andrew Johnson was no friend of black folks.
Absolutely.
And he was one of these people that basically wanted to try to sew things back together as quickly as possible, basically slap the hand of the former Confederates, and then basically declare everything was hunky-dory. So there was an attempt in the South by the former Confederates to reintroduce slavery. It was called Black Codes. And it was essentially slavery by any other name. It was slavery. And the Black Codes actually got struck down as a result of a turn of Reconstruction into a more militant attempt at building powerful black folks and building powerful poor people in the South. So there were about 10 years when there were remarkable experiments in the South at various forms of democracy, the introduction of public education, etc. But the former Confederates and their allies never could accept this, which may sound familiar. They could never accept these victories and were determined to overturn them. which over time, between roughly 1868 and 1876, they were very successful in overturning many of these victories. And then certainly at the end of 1877, when federal troops pulled out of the South, that was it, almost. But the former Confederates, who by now have renamed themselves the Redeemers, the Redemptionist movement, or the Redeemers, they begin introducing the kinds of systems that you're describing, and the convict lease system becomes a really important mechanism for the de facto re-enslavement of millions of Africans. And it's interesting, the way it's done is much like other systems that we've created in the South, the introduction of non-racial laws, right? It didn't say that if a black person was walking down the street and was out of work, that they could be jailed. Mm-hmm. It was much more subtle.
Right.
It was, you know, that there were these various provisions that were established that on their face appear to be race neutral, but they weren't. And so one of the things that was used was the anti-vagrancy law.
Vagrancy, absolutely.
Right? And so basically what that meant was, we don't use that term much anymore, except in some housing issues. But basically it meant if you were unemployed or homeless, and you were wandering through an area with no familial connection, you could basically be described as a vagrant and then jailed. And this was used disproportionately in the South against people of African descent. And so what this then did is it builds up this prison population, which becomes is offered out to private employers at a fee. So that the states were making money, these private employers were making money, and the imprisoned, now, I was getting ready to say enslaved, but the imprisoned people of African descent got nothing. And so this system became very, very important in terms of the development of what has come to be known as mass incarceration. And it's been, and it's actually something that the labor movement in the United States, despite the fact that the labor movement in the United States is very complicated, very contradictory, it's something that it fought against.
Right.
Because one of the things about convict labor, just like slave labor, is that free labor can never compete successfully.
That's right.
With unfree labor.
That's right.
Right? A point that Karl Marx tried to make and a lot of other people did, and is often forgotten.
Yes, and, you know, it's Douglas Blackman, of course, you know, dealt with this convict lease system in his seminal book, The Convict, Slavery by Another Name.
That's right.
Because, and as some of the audience may not know, but the National African American Reparations Commission is working on a case around convict lease labor in Atlanta, Georgia, the Chattahoochee Brick Company. This is an incredible story of the extraction of black wealth from thousands and thousands upon people who worked in the brick company. But then with the mayor of Atlanta, who built this brick company, and a lot of the bricks, therefore, were made from convict list labor. But then he leased out these incarcerated throughout Georgia and throughout the South. And one of the things that has been discovered, and I think Cam Howard did a little research on this and others have validated it, that the revenue from convict leased labor constituted a huge part of the budgets of Southern states way up into the 30s, into the 40s. I mean, it's unbelievable the amount of extraction. And in the case of the Chattahoochee Brick Company, I mean, it went through successive. English made so much money he had to create a bank to hold it, and then it went through different iterations. The final iteration of which is the derivative is Wells Fargo. I mean, it is incredible in terms of this kind of extraction, you know, of wealth that a lot of times our people don't think about. We only think about it in terms of enslavement. We don't think about the other ways post enslavement, which is bad enough, obviously. This is the most horrific of the crimes. But when we start talking about reparations, we have to look at much more. And so, Bill, I also wanted you, because I know you've looked at these issues as well, because there was a period when there were all these consent decrees and all these things were going down. Because, you know, throughout not only the South, but up South, I mean, black people were either prohibited from working in certain jobs. In the South, the prohibition was, well, if you have to work these jobs, you'll get a lower wage from doing exactly the same work. But in the North, it was more common to have, like, you know, for lack of a better term, the sort of the Negro jobs, the labor gang. And then you just couldn't go beyond a certain level. You couldn't get into the better paying jobs in the various industries. So I'm wondering whether you would just share your knowledge about how impactful that was in terms of the extraction of black wealth.
Sure. But first, let me just say, in terms of this point you were making about reparation, I don't think that can be said enough, Ron, that the issue of reparations for people of African descent in the United States, it's not like there's this timeline from 1619 to 1865. That what you're looking at is a system that was put into place that enslaved us and then put us under continued oppression that way outlasted 1865. And starts to factor in other people of African descent who end up migrating, either voluntarily or involuntarily, to the United States. We can talk about that more at another point. But the issue of labor and the sort of dual labor market, it really starts in 1865. With the end of the Civil War, there's this workforce issue, and the issue is what to do with all these freed African workers. So before 1865, the trade union movement had developed as a basically white movement, because Africans could not, by definition, become members of a union because they weren't free, unless they happened to be free in the North, and then they were still excluded by and large. Okay, so in 1865, you have this mass of freed black labor that's out there. And there's this question of, well, what's going to happen to it? And does it get organized by the different unions? But also, what happens in different industries? So what you start to see in the South is something that's really remarkable, particularly when we get, you know, 100 years later into discussions about affirmative action. You have the systematic driving of skilled African labor out of industries, out of the railroads, and out of the building trades in the South. And so when folks often think about, for instance, black folks in the railroad industry, well, we often go to Pullman porters, you know, or waiters. But no, in the 1860s, if you looked at the railroads in the South, you had black labor throughout the entire workforce. Mm. I mean, including engineers, firemen, oilers, etc. And they are systematically driven out and replaced with white labor. When I say driven out, Ron, I don't mean just simply they're given a layoff notice. People are killed.
That's right.
And they were assassinated, driven out of these jobs. And then there was an alliance between skilled white labor and these various companies to exclude black labor or to keep black labor in very, very subordinate positions. So it goes back to 1865. Now, within the trade union movement, there's always been a battle. Mm-hmm. And when I say always, I mean always. From the 1860s on, there's been a battle between two ideas. One is whether to fight to organize everybody versus a fight to organize only a small group of people and privilege them. And so you see that throughout history. In the when you were talking about consent decrees, the consent decrees were agreements that were arrived at as a result of lawsuits that were filed by black workers, and in some cases, other workers of color, against racist discrimination, getting into skilled, usually in the skilled position, like in the building trades or skilled positions, as you mentioned, your father faced in the steel industry. And these agreements were the result of struggle, not because someone was being nice. There were lawsuits, there were battles, there were organizations like in New York, there was the Harlem Fight Back, Black Economic Survival, and other groups that took on the fight around breaking down those doors. The thing about the skilled trades, and it shows you the way white privilege operates at a psychological level, is that what these very skilled positions, skilled jobs around, they froze in place certain white groups, usually ethnically. So there might be, you know, a particular local that was mainly Irish, another that was mainly Italian, one that it was largely Greek. And sometimes these mixed, but sometimes, you know, other times they didn't. But they didn't include us. They didn't include Puerto Ricans, right? They didn't include Asians. And the idea was that someone that was in a skilled position had the right of first refusal, in effect, over bringing on a relative. So jobs started being passed from father to son or uncle to nephew or whatever over time. And it took place within these ethnic groups and then sometimes across them, leading many of these white workers to believe that they were somehow entitled to these jobs, that there was something that had been written maybe 5,000 years ago that said that they were entitled to have these jobs, so that when we show up at the door, what we often face is this attack, this backlash that says, you are trying to take my job. No, I'm trying to get a job.
Right.
And you do not have any right to control that job in terms of who comes in. But that level of privilege is so built in that you see it to this day in many of the skilled trades where there's resentment when we're talking about desegregating, whether it's desegregating racially or gender-wise.
Right. Absolutely. Well, Bill, a lot that we could cover. I'm wondering whether you would sort of talk to us a bit as we, in the next several minutes, about sort of the value of organized labor in general, but particularly black labor, and kind of where do we stand today? It's amazing that, and again, I had not looked up the figures. I was afraid that the jump into the 30s, though somewhere or another that 30 to 35% was in my head. Mm-hmm. But we know there's been that was a precipitous decline. There are a lot of reasons for that. But now there is increasing interest right now in this period. A lot of different things are happening differently. But it's almost like in the United States, it's almost like labor is this alien foreign thing. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And we have a Labor Day. And the reason why I thought it was important was for us to actually discuss labor and its history and its background, particularly for black folk who have really played leading roles in different ways in the shaping, you know, of the labor movement and have benefited because of unions. So I'm just wondering whether your thoughts about where we stand and where we might be moving.
Well, it might come as a surprise to many listeners. African Americans are the most pro-union ethnic group in the country. And we also are the most unionized, believe it or not, ethnic group. In other words, a greater percentage of African Americans are unionized compared to other groups. Now, that may shock people. It doesn't mean that we're the majority of the labor movement. I mean, as a percentage of our own population.
Right.
And any good organizer will tell you that if you go into a non-union workplace where there's black workers will almost always be the first to respond to a message of unionization, and black women workers will be at the top of the list. And there's a long history to that. I mean, really, literally going back to the 1860s. But you could certainly see it in what happened in the 1930s, et cetera. The decline of the percentage of workers that are in unions is not because of lack of interest, but because we have an incredibly hostile situation of labor, of relations between the employer class and workers, greater than any other advanced capitalist society. Incredible hostility that is not just exchanges in newspapers, but it's like imprisoning people, assassinating people, intimidating workers who want to exercise the right to self-organization. And then what happens in the 1970s, because of the failure of the leadership of organized labor to follow a real path of strategic organizing, to continue and to organize new, so-called new workforces, by the 1970s, with a shift in global capitalism, we start to see the relocation of different industries. Your own state, Ohio, was a major a flashpoint in the loss of jobs. And the loss of those jobs as companies moved either to the South or moved overseas or just simply shut down had a disproportionate impact on black workers, which is one that an impact that is not sufficiently addressed. When we hear about the loss of jobs, and particularly, God help us, when people talk about some of these lunatics who voted for Trump, you think about a white worker, an angry white worker who lost a job. But no, we should, if you want to talk about angry workers, let's talk about black workers. Let's talk about Puerto Rican workers. Let's talk about Chicano workers who disproportionately lost their positions as a result of this real shift in the economy. And what's happening now, which you mentioned at the beginning of the show, is that once again, there's greater interest in unionization. Unions, I just found out today, have won more battles for representation than they have in 20 years, and significantly more. And this interest is this underlying feeling that people are having across racial and ethnic and gender lines that something's got to change.
Right.
And therein lies the question of organization.
Well, yeah, we're on our way. Some very promising things are happening. I guess, Bill, your final thought on the case for reparations. You stated it earlier. We had a major discussion last week about global issues and what happened in Accra and Bellagio and what happened in Colombia and just how the reparations movement is surging. H.R. 40 is out there. But this strand, and you talked about it earlier, that it is not just for enslavement, but all of the derivative exclusionary policies that have harmed, injured, and restrained and constrained, crippled, if you will, black communities post-emancipation. So your sense of why this discussion on black labor and black extraction of black wealth is an important factor in terms of the case for reparations.
Well, I think I start on the question of reparations as a global issue. And I know you agree with me on this, and not a domestic issue.
Right.
Not exclusively a domestic issue, that we're talking about, we're essentially talking about the post-1492 world. I bought this T-shirt the other while I was on vacation at this Indian store in Cape Cod, and it says, party like it's 1491. And it's like, I think people have to understand, we're talking about addressing the impact of what has happened since 1492. Now, that may seem very overwhelming, but that's the reality. We're dealing with what happened as a result of the invasion of the Western Hemisphere, further colonizations and enslavement. Now, here in the United States, what drives me nuts is when I hear anyone say, well, reparations is only about people that can prove that they were in a direct lineage to slavery. Well, like, what does that mean, right? Direct lineage to what, U.S. slavery? Or what about slavery in Jamaica, right? And that led someone then ultimately to leave Jamaica and come to the United States. I don't know, pick out a name arbitrarily, Marcus Garvey, right? And so what does that mean? And so we've got to understand that the case for reparations does not end with the end of formal slavery, that the continuation of our oppression, which has been documented and redocumented, is a case for repairing the damages that have been created, the systemic damages that have been created. And part of that has been the way in the workforce that we have frequently been excluded from opportunities, excluded in many cases from jobs entirely. And so the case for reparations to me is it's an ongoing matter as opposed to something that ended at a particular period.
Right. All right, Bill Fletcher, always great to have you on to lay out the case. I'm going to be reaching out to you and Earl O'Fari Hutchinson since the midterms are heating up, the official, yes, quote-unquote, season is about. So I'm going to bring the dream team on. I'll send you out a note so you can help provide some analysis, because this is arguably one of the most, well, it's not even arguable, it is one of the most consequential elections in the history of the United States. People are now trying to make a big deal out of the one little phrase, the gotcha press and the gotcha of this, and everybody's dwelling on semi-fascism. Oh, he said semi-fascism. I mean, this is ridiculous. But anyway, we'll talk about that next week or the week after. I'll reach out to you about it. Thank you so much, Bill, for informing us and enlightening us on Labor Day.
Okay, take care, then.
All right, Bill Fletcher. Again, a hopefully informative discussion for our audience, the exploitation of black labor and the extraction of black wealth, the case for reparations. Let's go to our listening audience now. I promised that we would have a few minutes, and we do have a few minutes for callers. I went a little over, but, it's hard to the interviews sometimes are so informative that it's difficult to constrain people. But we can have rapid response. People who want to call in and comment on what they heard, add to what they heard, any comments from last week that we did not get in. The call-in number is 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877. The phones are wide open right now. You don't have to hesitate or wait. You can call right now and you will get instantly into the conversation, or we'll get a stack because we have lots of lines open that you can jump on. The other thing I just want to quickly mention is if there are those who enjoyed the program today and last week's program on reparations, which I took the last half an hour to make a direct appeal for support for WBAI, I made a pledge of $100, and I was hoping others would join us, and we have had some, but still not too late to do so. I'm going to pitch it again. You can call 212-209-2950 to match the professor's pledge of $100 or make whatever contribution on Labor Day that you think will help advance the cause of sustaining and developing WBAI. But the phones are wide open now to talk about Labor Day, the status of black labor, the case for reparations in relationship to the exploitation of black labor and extraction of black wealth. We had a great conversation about the triangular trade. What did that mean? Hopefully, that's an area that I find that very often people are not very much aware of. Sharecropping, tenant farming, sharecropping, tenant farming after the sale, and agricultural labors post emancipation. But really, perhaps even most egregiously, the convict lease system. which really extracted huge amount of wealth from black folks. And then all of the racially exclusionary policies that barred black people from working in certain areas. And in the South, Bill referred to affirmative action. It was reversed affirmative action. In order to get black people to buy into the Jim Crow system of U.S. apartheid, white workers were promised that they would never, ever have to, you know, have shared facilities, public facilities with black people. But some of them said, well, that may not be enough. And so it went beyond that to saying, therefore, we will create jobs that will only be for white people. And if you have to work with them niggas, then here is what you will get is extra pay. It was a affirmative action program for white people. All right, let's go to our listening audience for a rapid response. Let's keep our response to about a minute if we can so we can get as many in as possible. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Good afternoon, Vantage Point representative. The guest you had was one of the most knowledgeable guests that I have heard on WBAI in quite a while, who could help to actually resolve some of the problems, both from a racial standpoint and a political standpoint. And since WBAI is a 99 representative for the listeners, I think that we definitely need to look at it in a more larger scope, so that working people can pull together. We had that energy during the Floyd situation. They came out and protested together, all colors. If we can get that to happen, we have more of a chance of getting our reparations and getting the country back on track. Thank you for having such a knowledgeable guest. I will look him up as well.
Okay, thank you very much. The guest was Bill Fletcher. That's right, Google Bill Fletcher. He is just, I love having Bill on. He is so knowledgeable. Let's go to our next caller. Thank you so much for calling in. This is, you're on Vantage Point.
Oh, hello. Yes. At the beginning of your introduction, that this is Labor Day, and you said what a lot of us know, what this audience knows, that Americans, working class, is among or are the least advantaged, the most disadvantaged working class among the wealthy countries. And I'm wondering, we kind of take that for granted. I've taken that for granted for years. But I'm wondering, what's your opinion about why that is? Why are we exceptional in the sense that we don't have national health insurance, and we don't have affordable education, and we don't have unemployment insurance that lasts as long as your employment lasts, the way it is in Europe? Why is that? And why do we take it for granted now? We're so used to it, but why do you think that is? It's a big subject, I know.
It is. I'll give you a quick answer, and we could explore that because I had the privilege of really teaching the political economy of Black America, and I learned a lot. And then when I did my doctoral work, I had to study Europe and see the differences. And I think there are two or three major differences. One is, racism has been used as a strategy to divide and exploit workers. You know, back in the day, there was a slogan, black and white unite and fight. Well, that's been difficult because one of the key issues has been, it has been white working class people who will buy not only the psychological bird, but have been bribed into believing that somehow if, and Bill referred to this, if somehow black people or Latinos or Asians, and if they get jobs, somehow that's taking away. So that's one of the issues that we've never been able to overcome. The other is how labor is organized. You see, and there was a battle, Bill referred to this to some degree, over whether or not there would be a labor movement where there would be no separation of skilled and unskilled workers. Well, in the United States, they made a choice to separate between the AFL-CIO and let me not get into it because I may forget which one is which. But anyway, they separated out the skilled laborers from the unskilled laborers. And even within the skilled laborers, they separated them out by craft. So in Europe, you can have a general strike. You can have a general strike in which you can shut down huge sectors of the economy. And it's like people feel a little inconvenienced, but it's a part of the culture of what might be called these democratic socialist countries that have some degree of democratic socialism. We don't have that in the United States. In fact, we have a hostile National Labor Relations Board primarily, but you can't if one craft goes out, the other craft can't join it. And then you have a separation between skilled labor and unskilled labor, and then the issue of race is always present. And that has been a major obstacle to us really having the kind of quality of life that Europe has, that Americans have no clue about, because we're fed this whole nonsense about American exceptionalism and all that, until you actually look at the benefits and the quality of life of workers in Europe is much better. So thanks so much. I know that's not a complete answer, but I want to get on to another call. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Hello?
Hello. You're on the air.
Hi. This is Mickey from the Bronx. Thank you for, as always, you always have a lot of gems. To me, as I heard the brother speak, and I feel like the damage is so deep. You know, slavery doesn't even begin to touch on all the damage that has been done. And, you know, we need to stop adopting other narratives. You know, we could become maladaptive to it. You know, the thinking about ourselves. It doesn't allow for the honesty of all the damage, you know. Jail is still slavery, losing our land. This is happening today as we speak, in our homes, and experimenting and separation of our families. The damage is deep. I just feel like it's the same thing as saying what's white privilege, you know. It's ongoing, you know, the damage that is done. So thank you for allowing me to say something.
All right. I appreciate you calling. Again, our number is 212-209-2877. We maybe can squeeze in one or two more calls. 212-209-2877. I think we have one more caller on the line now. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Yes, good afternoon. Post-emancipation, poll tax, literacy test, separate but equal. The progress in this country, I am for reparations, and I believe it will happen. The progress, though, in this country since the end of the Civil War has been, it has taken a superhuman effort.
Right.
The gains that we've made have been yielded grudgingly, and often they've been reversed, white backlash, reversed and often subverted. And clearly, we haven't gotten to the root of the problem. And my final comment about it is that, you know, when you're making progress and it's measured in centuries and it's measured in tenths of a percentage point, obviously there isn't enough progress that has been made. Now, I do have a quick question, and it is, I'm confused about your opinion about 40 Acres and a Mule. I know that Sherman, and I'm sure you know this, that Sherman issued Special Field Order Number 15, which was approved by Lincoln to allocate 40 acres. And keep up the good work. And I just
Bill Fletcher alluded to that in general, but it was vetoed by Andrew Johnson. That was the issue. And not only was it vetoed by Andrew Johnson, then they turned around, and Lincoln may have even played a role in this, and they actually compensated the former slaveholders, particularly in those states that were not considered active belligerency against the Union, which was the limitation of the Emancipation Proclamation, by the way. The Emancipation Proclamation did not free all the slaves or enslaved Africans. That's why the 13th Amendment was necessary. Because if you were in like Maryland or I forget, maybe Arkansas, there were some of these states where they were border states. And they did not join the Confederacy, but they had slaves. And so there was kind of like a little bribe in there saying, okay, well, if you go along and don't join, then we will compensate you for freeing the slaves. And that also happened in the District of Columbia as well. And that's one of the great ironies and tragedies is that enslaved Africans have not ever received reparations, but the slaveholders have. And this is not only true in the United States. In Britain, you see time and time again that that people are compensated for the loss of, quote unquote, their property. Well, we're out of time. And another great show, I hope. And we're going to pick it up next week. Probably going to invite Bill Fletcher and Earl LaFarge Hutchinson to come and talk about the midterms and what does it mean and where are we. But again, thank you for joining us on this edition of Vantage Point, 99.5 FM, the Pacifica Dial, in collaboration with YCRadio.org. See you again next week here on Vantage Point.